recording, so it must be recording.
Something's happening. And I also see that you have literally my favorite scotch.
Really?
Right here on your right side.
You like Battle Hill?
I'm a huge Balvenie fan.
Oh, a Balvenie fan. Yeah, this actually, it looks like that. It looks like the Balvenie bottle, but it's Battle Hill.
And I should have my glasses on in all honesty, because that looked like Balvenie.
I know, it does look like it. There he is. Well, welcome to Music on the Rocks. I'm Chris Castellanos, and I have with me one of my favorite people, and I don't get to see him this often, but this is Jeff Scott. And if you don't know who Jeff Scott, then first of all, you're not a brass player. But second of all, you've heard him. You've heard him on Broadway. You've heard him with the Imani Winds. He's recorded with tons of people from Streisand, Luther Vandross. And I mean, it's just, come on, man. it's so good to see you, man. Cheers.
Thank you, brother. Thank you very much. Cheers. I was going through Dublin Airport about a year and a half ago. Had some downtime, and they had this incredible scotch store. It was all they sold was scotch. Right. And I'd never heard of this one here. This is called Teeling.
I don't know that.
Yeah, it's a Dublin, you know, local single malt. Wine cask. They say it is single grain and non-chill filter. I don't know what that means, but it's good.
Well, the important part. I mean,
it is a really smooth, it goes out smooth as anything. It's not too peaty. I'm not a big fan of the real peaty, like Oban and stuff like that. Uh-huh. Like they're good, but it's a little too musky for me.
Yeah, I'm with you. I like a smooth drink. I like something that goes good with a cigar, even though I don't smoke cigars all that often.
Neither do I, but when you have one.
Yeah, when you have one.
But I'm smooth.
I can only do it on the last day of tour also. That's like the worst idea ever, is having a cigar on the first day of tour. And then the rest of the tour, your whole suitcase smells like smoke. And you are, oh, yeah. So this must be like the first time you're off the road in a long, long time. Because you've been on the road longer than me. Like a long time.
We were just having this conversation, the group, about... we were just saying, joking, or trust me, it was a joke. We were talking about how it seems like everybody's on vacation during the pandemic.
Right.
And I said, well, you know, in all honesty, this is the first time period off I've had since I joined the group. 23 years. Whoa. And I have not missed a show.
Incredible, man.
Not even for getting sick, not, you know, nothing. Never missed a show.
How many days a year are you guys usually on the road?
It's a lot less these days than it was in the early and the mid years. We would be on the road 175 to 200 days routinely, back up until I'd say around 2007 or so, 7 or 8. Then we kind of slowed it down, but really not terribly much. So that we're probably on the road about a third of the year. It's about 125, 130.
That's a good amount.
It is. Yeah,
not too much.
No, it's not too much. And what ended up happening was we got fortunate in the last, I'd say, 8 or 9 years or so, we started getting residencies. Mm-hmm. And they pay better, they're more consistent, they keep you in one place. And they make it so that you don't have to do every little job, you know, because you're getting a really good substantial amount of your income.
It is nice. The residency thing is right. Because not only are you in the spot for a longer amount of time and you can kind of like unpack for maybe a week or a little bit longer, but you also get the time to like know people more, like know the students, know the people, know the presenters. Yeah.
I mean, I know you guys do this too. You read like compositions of the student composers and stuff like that. And when you're doing a residency and you come back maybe two times in a year, three times and more if you're fortunate, you know, these composers really, really get a chance to get a feel for what it's like to write for that type of an ensemble.
Right.
You know, on a professional level. And I think that's invaluable, you know.
Mm-hmm.
You guys in the brass world, you got some pretty happening repertoire, I have to say. Brass quintet repertoire is like smoking.
Hey, you guys can play more notes though, man.
Oh,
clarinet and oboe.
Flutes can. They want to think I can play a whole lot of notes. But we, you know, we have to cultivate these young composers and really, you know, be right up with them, man, and letting them know what's possible, what's not possible, so we get some better music, you know, coming out.
Yeah.
And it's starting to happen, but it's because of those residencies.
Hmm. Well, that's awesome, man. That's just great for music education as a whole to have chamber musicians to come in and sit with them. Right. You guys are on the road, you're doing it, and you're doing what a lot of them want to do. It doesn't get better for students.
Right. So. I mean, I don't know about you, but that's how I got kind of turned on to music, is having somebody come into my school. And this was before college, you know, clearly, but, you know, I came into my school and there was this guy on the stage, like, playing all the notes, man. like really playing all the notes, you know. And then he got up and he demonstrated and he looked comfortable on stage and he was funny. And I was like, man, I want to do that, you know. I want to be like that. So yeah, you gotta get right up in their stuff, man. Show them what it's about.
Something that you just said like really hits home. We were just talking to Marty Hackelman the other day. Boston Brass was we were interviewing him for one of our hangs.
Yep.
And he was talking about how important the stage presence part is. You know, I mean, that the fact that you're on all the time, even when you're not on. So how you look at the people when they're playing and you're not, how you're presenting yourself when you might, if you were in an orchestra, just kind of be sitting there and like looking around, or, you know what I mean? Like, you can't do that. There's only five people on stage, you know?
That's right.
And you have to build a rapport with the audience. You can't just play at them and ignore them or just talk at them. You have to talk with them and to them and involve them in some fun way, you know?
And in all honesty, that's a learned skill.
Mm-hmm.
Some people really have the knack for it right off the bat, and other people just have to kind of cultivate it because maybe you don't project with your voice very well. Maybe you don't make eye contact very well. Right. Maybe you say certain things repeated. You don't even know that you're saying. But this was my thing, man. Monica, our bassoon player, Imani Wins, you know, especially during children's concert, I'd finish my demo and she'd say, yeah, if you say, and I can't remember what the phrase was, but she'd say, if you say that phrase one more time.
I exactly know. I do the same thing. I went through like a period of time where on stage, like I would just say like, you know what I mean, after stuff.
Yes, it would be something like that. Exactly.
And I'm like, and I listened to recording myself. I'm like, why am I saying, you know what I mean? They're going to tell me, yeah, I know what you mean. It's like, just shut up and talk, kid.
Oh man, that is exactly what I'm talking about. And that kind of thing, you don't even realize it. Once you can get out all of the, you know, the little idiosyncrasies like that, like repeating things or talking low. Yeah. Once you can get that, it just makes the whole presentation so much better.
And it's something, unfortunately, we don't practice in school. You know, we're practicing the music and we care about hitting the notes and all this stuff, but the actual presentation part, we're not thinking about that much until you get on stage and you're like, oh, I don't know what to do.
I remember being in a chamber music masterclass once, and we were trying to get the two musicians that had like a little duet to communicate with one another, like mm-hmm. like literally look at each other and gesture, and they thought it was just the hokiest thing that, like, you know, they were, I mean, they didn't refuse to do it, but right. It's just like, I don't want to, you know. I said, well, just think about, like, think about the best love song duet you've ever heard in, like, you know, soul music, rock music, country music, whatever it is. And you go to that concert, and those people that are singing that duet are not even looking at each other. Yeah. They don't even, like, they're singing the duet, one's looking down, and the other one's looking over there. And it might sound good. You're like, you can't believe that they're singing. It's the same thing. You're showing that you actually know that this is a duet, and you're emoting with one another.
Well, the audience feels it, man. You're so right. You're totally right. So anybody listening right now, when you're practicing your recitals, all that stuff, you need to figure out what it is that you're going to say also. And you need to figure out, practice it on people. Practice. I mean, it sounds silly to play like part of your recital for like your parents or like your friends, but you will, mark my words, you will play differently. Even if it is just for your parents, you'll start to feel weird and awkward. And imagine now that you're in front of an audience for the first time doing that. So it's like, you really need to get used to that. Just like,
yeah,
rapport, man.
I 100% agree, man.
So when did you start playing the horn, age-wise? Where were you in school?
I was in the seventh grade.
Oh, me too.
Sixth grade, we did, we chose our instruments, and my band director gave me, well, he told me it was the French horn, but it was actually E-flat mellophone. One of the marching ones, the ones you hold like this, with the opposite hand.
Oh my goodness, I have one of those, man. It's cruel. You had to play that?
Yep, I sure did. But he told me that, and he had a French horn in the closet, but I think he was trying to give me an instrument where the notes would actually come out a little easier to start. Yeah. And I took to it real quick, and then it was definitely in the spring the following year, he gave me the French horn. Mm. And so I started playing a French horn, and right away, you know, took to it.
One of those kids that was like all about it when you first started, or did you have to like kind of feel it out?
Well, I was all about it, but you know, I grew up in Queens, New York. Mm. And the kids in Queens can be rough, man.
You see a kid walking around with his little French horn.
You know, the weird shaped case and the whole thing, man. And I was the only one that chose the French horn. I had to be the odd one. Everybody, you know, they all played sax and trumpet and so on, clarinet.
Right.
And I was trying to be cool and different. And then he pulls out this thing, especially when he pulled the French horn. The one that we had, we only had one. It looked like somebody took it and threw it against the wall four times and tried to smooth out the creases. It was just a piece of trash, man. And of course, the kids just brutalized me. I mean, they brutalized me. It's like, oh my God. But I think that actually encouraged me a little bit. You know, like I really worked to try to make a really good sound. And I took to it right away. I don't know why, because classical music was like, literally third or fourth in my list of things. I wanted to be a baseball player or a cartoonist. I had no...
Cartoonist?
Yes, man. Oh, man.
Did you draw?
Dude, I... As late as when I auditioned for college, I still didn't know if I wanted to be a musician. And so I auditioned also... I told my mom I would go to where I got the best scholarship help. Right. And so I said, I'm only going to go for the best school. So I auditioned for Manhattan in New York. I went to Manhattan School, Juilliard, and Manus. I went to Pratt University and FIT. And then I did, for baseball, I did St. John's, and I can't remember what the other school was. There was another good school for baseball. Mm-hmm. But the funny part was when I was doing my very first still life drawing part of my audition for Pratt.
Uh-huh.
They bring in, there's this table, all of us are sitting around the table, and this beautiful lady comes in, like a Greek goddess type of thing with this white covering, and she sits on the table, and we're supposed to sketch her.
Uh-huh.
And the proctor did say, use your imagination. And I was all into superheroes, man. I was into Batman and, you know, Spider-Man. So I gave her muscles and ripples and fangs and all this stuff. And I tell everybody this story. Like, the proctor came around the table to check out what everybody was doing, and she was like, nah, I don't approve. When she got behind me, the only thing she did was make the sound. That was it. Dude, I didn't get in.
Come on, that's creativity. What's wrong with her?
She wasn't having it, man. She was not having it. So I went to Manhattan School instead.
So your life might have taken a complete different trajectory if she was into cartoon art.
See? Right. Exactly. And, you know, in all honesty, at that time, there was no, you know, this big boom now of like the Avengers and, you know, all that stuff wasn't happening now. So I would imagine that, you know, if I could skip ahead 20 years, you know, somebody might have encouraged me to continue.
Right.
But I think I did all right.
I think you did all right also. Wow, I didn't know you could draw, man.
Well, I used to be able to. I decided just not to continue trying to do it.
Oh, really?
I loved it so much, you know.
Oh, that if you can't do it at like a high level, then.
Yeah. And so, like, I don't even know what I would do now. If you gave me a piece of paper and a pencil, it'd probably look like poo, you know.
But, well, I want to commission you to draw me as a superhero, man, with a horn and all that. And a bottle of Battle Hill next.
Yes! Done, son. You got it. I'll tell you what I did do, and this ties it back into music. My very first Broadway show, I won't say who the conductor was because I don't want to embarrass him, but he was a pain in the you-know-what, and he made my life and the lives of a lot of the musicians in the pit just a living hell. And to try to offset it, to try to like get through it, I used to draw him as this little like brat boy, almost like Dennis the Menace kind of thing. And I would put him in different situations, like little one frame, like one page, four frame situation. Right. Well, something horrible always happened to him in the end, you know, like a piano falling down on his head or something. And then I'd pass it through the pit.
Oh, that is awesome.
I still have, and I would gladly share those with you.
I would love to see them, man. I want to see some Jeff Scott art.
You would enjoy them. They're pretty good.
So how long did you play on Broadway?
That show opened in 1994.
Uh-huh.
That was my first show, and I played my last Broadway show with The Lion King in 2005 in January.
Okay.
And I had a show consistently from that. I won't say what that first show was because I really don't want to embarrass the guy. But I played that first show, 94. Then I segued almost directly into The Lion King and played Lion King for 7 years and then left it in 05.
Lion King came into Vegas for a while.
I would
sub over there and stuff, and it was a fun book to play.
You know, it's a monster book. It's a chop buster, but it's fun. It's got all this great horn stuff.
Did you have stuff to do with the movie that came out, the new movie?
Yeah. I actually went out and recorded the soundtrack out in L.A.
Yeah,
with Bane and all those guys that were out there, man. It was an invitation. They actually used two orchestras. And I think Stephanie wouldn't mind me. Stephanie Williams is this a violinist and contractor. And I don't think she'd mind me mentioning this. There was this orchestra that she put together called the Musicians Collective. I think it's something collective. But anyway, it's all African-American and Latino musicians from all around the country. And it's her sort of project, if you will, to try to get like the best players of African American Latino descent in one place, and then try to promote that orchestra to do work, studio work, all kind of famous singers, background, you know, whatever it is. And somehow, some way, she talked the folks in the Lion King family to bring them in to LA. It was an experiment because we were sitting side by side with all of the players of the staff orchestra there. Huh. And so principal played with principal, second played with second. And I have to say that was probably the most nerve-wracking experience I've ever had in my life. It's one thing if you're like playing principal and you just your part,
right?
But when you're like sitting next to somebody who's been doing it for their whole lives and you got to match, it's like being an assistant,
right?
But you got to match every note. Everything was doubled.
Wow! It was
like, oh my god!
And especially that, I just watched that movie like a couple weeks ago, actually, with my son, and I was surprised at how like close actually the music seemed to the musical. It was like,
yes.
I was getting flashbacks, you know?
Yeah, it's all pretty much it. I mean, there are some new episodes and new arrangements of the old songs, but it was pretty darn close. And that actually helped to make me get a little bit more comfortable because, you know, they were sending the practice charts like about a week before. And I was really thinking, man, it's going to be an all new thing. And then one by one, it's like, oh, I know this. Oh, it's good to be getting better. And I was like, I know these charts. Yeah.
That's really cool. Well, just remember for that collective, if you need any more Latinos, man, your boy is right here.
Dude, you got it. I'm actually surprised, in all honesty, that you're not part of it. Because it's like the who's who of players, and you know people, principal players of all these orchestras, African American, Latino, and you sit and you hear these people play, and I say to myself, man, I knew this existed, but it's another thing to sit in it and get that feeling that you get when you're playing in a group that just sounds incredible, like everything sounds incredible, and you're like in the middle of it. It's just like, whoa.
That's so cool.
They're brown. Well, you know, it's crazy. So
awesome.
Yeah.
Well, good for you, man. That's a really cool thing. I've been meaning to ask you about your new gig because I know you got a new gig, and now you are now at Oberlin, right?
I am now at Oberlin. Pinch me kind of situation.
I'm so happy for you. I got to tell you, I mean, not only are you such an amazing player and just a great person, but as an educator, you've been doing it for a really long time for a lot of different schools and a lot of different people with the Imani Wints, and you really know how to teach. When you're traveling around and doing master classes for over two decades, you know how to get through to students.
Appreciate you saying that. You know, it's, I put it on the level of like winning a major orchestra job because, you know, yeah, there are auditions that you take that you prepare for. You have no preconception that you're going to actually get it, but you go and you do it because you should. It's there. The opportunity is there. And you're, you know, I'm still kind of young, you know, so I go for it. But I really did not, I didn't think I was going to actually get the job. It's an honor because the lineage there. I mean, one of my former teachers was a student there, and three members of the Imani Wins went to school there. I mean, it's a major, major responsibility. And so I'm super stoked. Super, super, super stoked.
I'm super stoked for you, man. I mean, I have a feeling that you're going to leave a real legacy there, you know, and that's one of the really cool things about these great players who are getting these teaching jobs where they're going to be there for a long time, and you're paying it forward to all these students and passing on your knowledge. And it's only a positive thing for everybody who goes and gets their art lives touched by you. So I'm really happy for you.
Thank you. I really, really appreciate you saying that. I'm really excited. And that school, I have to say, and this is something that I sensed long before getting the job, and primarily because of the members of the quintet that are Obies. There's this sentiment amongst people who've gone to school there that anything's possible. They're just kind of like part of this I can do sort of club, you know? And I think it comes from the way it's cultivated there on the campus. It's an extremely progressive campus and an extremely progressive city with a history. And I don't know if you know the Oberlin history, but it was a first for a lot for African Americans, and played a primary part along the Underground Railroad trail heading up north. There's a huge, huge history of the progressiveness of the institution. And you see that in the students, that they, even at 18 years old, they expect to succeed. Mm-hmm. It's just a matter of, let me get through these 4 years, you give me what I need, and I'm gonna go do what I wanna do. Yeah. And I have to say, I went out there for a day for the audition. You do, you know, the interviews, and you do a masterclass and a recital, and all of that was plenty enough for nerve wracking. But the thing that really like made me sort of breathe in a little bit, they leave you for 90 minutes with the horn studio alone, and they get to ask you anything and everything. And let me tell you, these students were prepared and they were asking very pinpoint questions like, what are you going to do for me if ... How do you think of ... And if I came to you with this problem, how would you correct it? And I mean, you have to you can't fake that. You know what I mean?
That's really cool, man. I think it's really cool that they're involving the students and having the students have some sort of a say, because they're the ones who are dealing with you all the time, and they're the ones who are paying a lot of money to come study with you, you know? Right. So what can you do for me?
Right. Yeah, I mean, it really, you can't come to that with this, I'm Mr. Jeff Scott kind of a mentality, you know?
Yeah.
It's like, all right, we're gonna work this out together, you know, and I got a lot of experience and I think a lot of knowledge, but I'm gonna figure out how I can get it from me to you, and each one is gonna be different on how we do it, but we're gonna figure it out, you know?
Yeah.
So I'm looking forward to it, man. I really am.
With the history of the school and the fact that you come from where you came from Queens, and this guy with a little awkward French horn walking down the street and stuff, and people make fun of you or whatever. And now, you know, you've been part of for two decades of one of the most successful chamber ensembles that there has been. And you're teaching at one of the great music schools. It's really inspiring. And so for students,
pinch me, man. You know,
but it could happen to a nicer dude, man. That's another thing I like about you, is how important it is to just have a persona that you're like, you can deal with people and people want to be around you. It's like, if you're on a freelance scene, look, everybody can show up and play. They have to. Everybody, you know, they do all the stuff that they're supposed to. So what's to set you apart from other people? And that is this part. It doesn't have to be a real drink or but it's the conversation. It's the hanging out. It's like, that's who I want to work with. So, hey, next time I have a horn player that I need, it's like, bring over this person. She's awesome. You know, I love hanging out with her. And it's like, I know that you're a dude, but I'm just, no shit.
But I get what you're saying. It's 100% that, and you can't underline it enough for young people, because I think, like you were saying in the opening when we started talking, you spend so much time just thinking about getting the notes. And I know that there's a lot of pressure to succeed and be accurate. But man, you just, along the way, you just got to tell them, you got to be a real person. You got to, Yeah. You got to be likable. You got to be just, you know, somebody that people want to work with.
It's part of the gig. When it comes to the end of the day, nobody has to hire you, you know. They can hire whoever they want. You know? Ooh,
man, so, that's the truth.
But anyway, man, yeah, that's awesome. So how did you get involved with the Imani Wins? Were you part of the beginning of the group, or did you audition in, or were they friends of yours? I don't know the history of the group that well. I mean, I've known you for a long time.
Yeah.
I think I told you this, but yeah, when I was at Chautauqua Institute as a student, you guys did a residency, and I remember you coached
me. Oh, man, yeah.
Yeah, you coached me, man. And you said some really nice things, though, because I played an 8D at the time also. And you were like, you make the 8D sound really light. And how do you do that? And I remember having like this, like, I was like, oh, man, Jeff Scott just like gave me a compliment. That is awesome.
Oh, that's pretty cool.
Oh, it was awesome.
I do remember that summer, though. I do remember that summer. Listen, man, I so much happens because of just, you know, knowing people, like you said, friendship. The original horn player in Imani Wins, a guy named Marshall Seeley, amazing player, fun guy, New York and Boston based. And in 1997, when the group started, they wanted all the members to be African-American or Latino. And somebody had recommended Marshall to them. Marshall initially thought it was just a group that was gonna get together, read some music, and maybe occasionally do some like lobby gigs or something like that. And it would just be for fun, you know? Whereas Valerie Coleman, the flutist in the, you know Valerie, yeah, dude, she had it all visioned out from day one.
Wow.
To the point where we would laugh at her because there's no way this is gonna be a living. No one makes a living out of wind quintet.
It does not surprise me coming from Valerie, man. I mean, she is just really a force of nature. And she's on fire right now, man.
As they say in Fuego, the girl is lighting it up. And it's just, you know, I remember, and I can say this now, in the group, it was kind of one of those, she was one of those people you just roll your eyes like all the time because she's come with these big ideas that just seemed implausible, just literally implausible. And she would just say, no, we can do it. No, we can do it. No, we can do it. And then boom. And not only would we do it, it would be the thing that would propel the group to the next big right. level. And that's the kind of, she's that big thinker type person. And man, yeah, talking about somebody that's an institution that's going to benefit from somebody. She's at the Frost School.
We were just there. Right before all this stuff went down, like I think in February we were there, and I saw Valerie. Yeah, she introduced us at the masterclass and everything.
Oh, sweet! Oh man, yes.
Great to see. I hadn't seen her personally since the last time we did one of our combined concerts.
Well, the Bring Your Best stuff.
Right.
Yeah. Man, wow. Well, that's a minute. Well, they're going to benefit from having her there. Because she was really the catalyst for it all. But anyway, so Marshall, like within a couple of months, he realized that there was just like too much rehearsing going on. And he really, really, he was a busy freelancer and had other things going on. And so he called me up and he was like, dude, I'm playing in this quintet. I think you'd like it. They're really cute. And they really, 100%. And so, yeah, I was like, sure, you know, I was just playing the show and I was like, sure, it'll be fun. Yeah. And I specifically remember being in a car going to a gig with another horn player friend of mine. Actually, the guy ended up taking over my chair at Lion King. His name is Greg Smith.
Oh, cool.
We were driving to some freelance gig and I was laughing with him. I was like, man, he's like, how's the quintet? I was like, dude, this crazy flute player. She came in today with a grid of like a projection of like, you know, what, where we'll be in like 3 years and 5 years, and that we'd have management and we'd be making CDs and touring. I'm like, she's out of her freaking mind. I swear to you, Greg and I laugh about that to this day, man. to this day. Like, she saw it all.
Every group needs that person. It seems like every group that is a chamber group that needs like a visionary person, they have at least one, like all the successful ones, they have one of those people, and they just like just drive and drive and drive, and you just kind of hang on and, you know, do what they ask of you and really try to help also, like, be creative. But you have to get past that point in your head where it's like, oh, this, yeah, that's probably not doable, or that sounds good. Or whatever, you know. I can't get past that a lot of the time.
I know.
Like on a drone sitting up here going, I'm going to be a millionaire or something like that. Like, yeah, that's somebody else is going to be a millionaire. I'm going to play the horn.
I know. I want to, but listen, man, like, I, my vision of you is like, I have this vision of Chris Castellanos, like, doing that. You know that movie, Lost in Translation?
Yeah,
I love and the that. Guy does the. He's like doing this. I think it's scotch. He's like promoting the scotch thing. You know, I see you first class in a plane somewhere with a scotch in one hand and the horn and a mute in another. That's my vision of you. And I'm like, this guy has the life. He literally has the life, man.
Had. Now I'm sitting at home all the time with like my 5-year-old spilling cereal and like a...
Excellent. That's beautiful though, man.
It is beautiful. Actually, this has been very hard because, you know, you want to be on the road. You want to be making money. You want to like be putting your career, make it go forward. But at the same time, I am the same as you where I hadn't been off the road for any time more than 3 weeks for 17 years. So, I mean, it's like now I'm home and I'm just like, I get to spend time with my wife. I get to spend time with my kids. I get to be outside gardening and stuff. It's just like in a garden. Yes. Garden, man. Like, I got my wife's pink gloves on. I'm like, what am I going to do?
I totally understand. I'm right there. But that's, you know, I mean, it's, you know, if any good can come out of this all, it's, you know, you really start to connect with the people that are close to you. Mm-hmm. I have been on the phone more in the last 3 months than probably in the last 3 years, you know, because I'm a text guy. Don't call me. Send me a text and I'll call you if it's important, you know. But now you can't see anybody.
Yeah.
You know, so everybody's calling and catching up and, you know. And so the good is, you know, I'm here with my wife and my 4-year-old. And it's, you know, we're really connecting on a level that, you know, just, like, no one gets this kind of time. This is just doesn't happen. This is forced on us, you know. And, you know, people will come out of this for the good or the bad. You're going to really, really know, like, your relationships, all of them, you know.
Oh, for sure.
You're really going to know your relationships.
I know what I've discovered about my relationship is that I'm a really annoying person and my wife is perfect.
I already knew that about myself. I mean, you're just...
She's an angel, man. She's an angel, and I'm just like this, like, super annoying. Like, I'm like, man, I need to get away from me.
That's hysterical.
So, where are you living now? Because I know that you got your new job. So, I mean, where?
Yeah, I bought this. We're in Naugatuck, Connecticut. It's like, if you're not from Connecticut, you don't know Naugatuck. But it's in New Haven County, which is where Yale University is. So I'm 25 minutes away from Yale.
Do you like it there?
I love it. And it wasn't necessarily like what I sought out, but when we decided we were going to do the whole marriage thing and I wanted to get a house with a backyard, you know, let's just put it this way. I was living in New Jersey. And there are some parts of New Jersey where a musician's dollar will stretch, but for the type of space and the type of schools and everything that I wanted, my musician salary wasn't going to do it. So I gave myself a 90, mile radius from Manhattan that I said I would do a commute in order to find a house with, like, you know, three bedrooms and a backyard and the whole thing. And I'll just commute in and so that my kid can roll in the backyard, you know?
Yeah, that's awesome, man. That's
so yeah. So I found this place and not, and also, you know, to be really honest, it had to be an area that was progressive enough because, you know, I'm a black guy and my kid's going to be going to schools and everything. And I just needed that to also be part of the equation. Okay. And so that search was difficult.
See, I'm not one to talk about, like, politics much or anything like that. But with everything that's going on right now, a lot of people don't understand, like, you know, they think, oh, well, Jeff Scott, he's got a job at a great place and he's got, like, he's got it going on. It's like, so maybe I don't even have a job that good, or I don't have it as, you know what I mean? They don't maybe have to think about, well, what neighborhood I move into or the school that my son goes to or my kid goes to so that they can feel comfortable and stuff. Those are things that they don't have to think about. So it's not all about, like, money, or it's not all about the prestige of what they've earned in their career and stuff, but it's like how they have to literally live and feel, you know. So
at the end of the day, you know, it's the most important thing, you know, the concerts and all the glam and all that stuff that happens, like, outside of your house. On the road, you take a plane and you go and you do your thing. When you come home, and you need that to be like a sanctuary, man.
Right.
You know,
you need it to be sanctuary.
Hey, who's that?
This is Orion. Hey, you want to say
hi? Buddy.
This is my friend Jeff. This is Orion.
Hey, Orion. I have a son too. He's almost your age. He's 4.
Jeff has a son who's 4.
I'm 6.
Wow, you're a big boy. Wow.
I even have a watch, but I ruined it because I went in the pool with it.
Okay. Well, I think you're okay. All right, bud. Hey. No, you can't play Fortnite. All right. Hey, I'm not going to argue with you right now because I'm talking with my buddy. Okay? And if I'm going to argue with anybody, it's going to be him. All right, bye, bud.
Oh, man. So it doesn't it doesn't change even at 6, huh?
No.
I was thinking, man, by the time he's 5, Tommy's going to grow out of all of that. You know?
Oh, man. The only thing that changes is that his vocabulary gets larger and he starts to be able to talk himself, like, out of things and into things. And, anyway, I think you had the right idea. I think I need to open this back up.
Top it off.
So I get this question a lot. Like, when I play sub in orchestras and stuff, and people are like, hey, so when do you think you'll get off the road and, like, kind of settle into an orchestra job? My answer is always, I love what I do. I'm a lucky day. It's like, I'm not knocking your orchestra job or anything, but honestly, I like playing in different venues all the time, playing the music that I've arranged and I've chosen, and hanging out with my boys. For you, it's the girls. Although you've got new members, so
yeah, new members. It's now three guys, man. So we're
now, that's something I would have never thought with Imani Wins, man.
I know. It's just me. I know, but I have often thought the same thing about you, because, man, like, you're such a super incredible player, and I was wondering, man, I wonder if he like auditions for orchestras, you know, and it's just a matter of time before he wins one, or if like this is what you do, because you sub in so many freaking groups. It's like ridiculous, man.
I have not taken an audition for anything ever since I joined Dallas Brass 17 years ago. It doesn't tickle my fancy. You know what I mean?
That is so crazy. And I mean, I guess I'm not really, really shocked, because somebody at your level would have won by now. You would have won something by now if you were auditioning. So it's really not that shocking. But that for 17 years, man, you definitely love your life.
I love what I do, man. I love being on the road. I love hanging out with new people. And I love chamber music is the bottom line. I think with orchestra world, I can get my fix. It's like somebody will play Heldenleben, somebody will play that, they'll play big works, or somebody will ask me to sub for them, like a principal or something, and I'll come in and play. But that's when I get to play with others. And then, but my home is on the stage with only a few people and playing solo, you know?
Yep.
I love that. But I kind of felt the same of you. It's like, first of all, our jobs, although they're kind of the same in that we're playing chamber music, they're completely different because of the style of music that we're playing all the time. And the stuff that you're playing, I would argue, takes a lot more finesse than what I do a lot of the time.
You know, and it's funny you say that, because I think Sarah Willis was having one of her horn hangs, and she was talking about how they were just now getting back to playing again. And they had like a brass thing that they were doing. Yeah. The Berlin Brass did some sort of virtual thing. And maybe it wasn't virtual, but it was socially distanced. And she was complaining at how it was killed her chops. You know, she says she's much more comfortable with woodwind playing, you know, but that the brass thing just, dude, not only do you like kill it in brass quintet, but you have the stamina. You can like kill it at that level and like sustain it at that level. And I just, you know, it's like a completely different style of playing. The finesse thing, you still get tired and you know, you have to figure out how to sustain. But I've never been able to do that dance that you do. You know, I'll get called to play a brass quintet gig and, yeah, I feel it, you know.
Well, I feel it too, man. I think the hardest part about playing, at least with the Boston Brass, is just keeping up with the horsepower that like Jose and Domingo put out. And it's just that those two in particular can really turn the heat up so much that it's like, if I'm not playing really loud and angling my bell out, it's like, I might as well just like put the horn in the case and go home, because nobody's going to hear me anyway.
Well, you do it, man. I have to say, you do it. And, you know, finesse playing and learning how to play, you know, at really strong levels of volumes and be accurate and in tune and still sound great for long periods of time. It's just two ends of the spectrum, and it's two like bona fide, legitimate, difficult ways to earn a living.
You know? You just said it. You said it, man. Okay, so I wanted to ask you a little bit about arranging, because I know that you do a good amount of arranging and you do a lot of writing. And one of your arrangements in particular that I really like is the Piazzolla, of course. The Libre Tango, and just the music is so freaking beautiful.
Beautiful.
And it's, you know, like you'll hear Piazzolla in clumps. It's like you hear a lot of them and then it kind of goes away. And then you hear a lot and it goes away. But that music should be played all the time. And it's so beautiful. But I mean, in particular, your arrangements, I think, are really thoughtful. And you arrange very well for woodwind quintet. And I'm not sure I would know where to start with woodwind quintet, even though my wife is a flute player. But how did you get into arranging? Did you take classes, or did it just kind of like you wanted to do it and you just got better as you did it, or how did that roll for you?
Yeah, I in my master's study, I was out at Stony Brook, and there was a professor there, a theory and composition professor named Jack Lessard. He's since passed away, but he used to give this orchestration course, and I knew I wanted to get into arranging, but I thought I'd sort of stick my toe in the water with this course, because I heard what he did was he would take like piano sonatas, and string symphonies and ask you to rearrange them for another ensemble. And that way you got to learn how to write for all the different instruments, you know, learn the winds and the brass and the percussion and so on. And so this was a chance for me to just learn like the basics, you know. Then the next thing in that same, during that same time period, we would, the brass players, well, really not just the brass players, but really all of the cool wind players would get together at the end of most of our orchestra concerts, and we do a jam session where somebody would, like, we'd go into like the student union, take over like one of the halls, and we'd get our amplifiers, and somebody would sing, and I'd do arrangements of like Earth, Wind, and Fire tunes for like horn, bass, clarinet, trombone, and singer. You know,
that is cool.
Right, we didn't have any drums. We didn't have, like, no, I take that back. We had a drummer. We didn't have, like, bass guitar and stuff like that, you know. We had just winds, and I would, like, totally, like, sketch out all these pop tunes. And that was kind of where I got, like, the bug. I did some arranging for this brass band that I used to play in called No Nanet. It was this experimental funk, jazz, pop band that I was in New York City. This guy named Rob Sussman put it together, and we would all write arrangements and new stuff because it was, you know, it was an instrumentation that didn't exist, so we all had to do it.
Right.
But the real thing was getting into Monty Winn's and hearing Valerie Coleman, like, spit out these arrangements, like, bam, bam, bam. Yeah. And I'm just sitting in it, and I'm hearing these colors and how she doesn't always use the same instruments for their regular roles. And,
yes.
You know, she just knew how to, you know, she's just one of those Ravel types, you know?
Yeah.
So I learned a lot listening to what she did. And, you know, the best part about being in a group that's steady, as you know, is you bring in an arrangement, and if you don't like a couple of bars that you did, you bring it home, you fix it, you bring it back the next day.
Yep.
And there, that is invaluable.
Yeah.
And it's just, you know, there, you know, if I'm a composer or an arranger and I don't have a staff ensemble that I could work with, and I'm just like throwing it out there to some group, I don't know what their feeling is. And 9 times out of 10, when Imani Wins gets something like that, if we don't want to be bothered with like the back and forth, we'll just fix it ourselves, you know? And you guys probably do it yourselves too. Like, you're like, dude, take that up an octave or play the third, because that arranger didn't voice that right, you know?
All the time. That's how I realized like how much work I need as an arranger. I mean, you know, because I didn't take any arranging classes. I just kind of did it like because I liked to do it. And I just got a little bit better because just trial and error, really.
Right.
And whatever sounded good was what I did. But I would be arranging tunes. When Sam Palafian was in the group, we would just play through something. And he's like, okay, well, at bar 30, we're changing the voicing of this. So now you're playing this, you're playing, because that's totally wrong. No, we're gonna change the end of it. It's like he would just correct all my shit, man, just like with the red marker, you know what I mean? Like I was back in school. That's C+. You got a C+ on this arrangement.
I love it, man.
And then you would hear how he changed just a voicing, and I go, damn, okay. Yep. It really, the colors really come out.
They ring. They literally ring. And, you know, the other thing is that you're playing with people who just have incredible technique and sound.
Right.
And so you get to hear colors and resonances that, you know, it's just, it's another level.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, I cut my teeth bringing in charts to Imani Winn's. And there's no better platform for your music, you know,
yeah.
A group like that, like putting your stuff out. And that's really propelled. I mean, I'm composing and arranging now I mean, for a time period, you know, it'll be different now that I'm at Oberlin, but it's kind of like close to 50-50 how I was earning my money with composing. I'm getting so many commissions now. You know, it's just...
good for you, man.
It's changed. Like, everything's just become... It's crazy. It's really crazy. And I love it, man. I love it. It's become like a... You know, like, I don't want to be like the mad composer type, like, that composes all day and comes out at night, you know, to like grease mare or something like that. But I don't know. I just, I have like this, it's almost like, in all honesty, it's almost like the same energy I had for cartooning.
Oh, okay.
Like, I get this, there's something about making a piece of music happen from a blank page, you know, and then like going back and like with my sketches, I would erase and fix a line. Same thing with the notes. I listen to it. Oh no, that chord would work better this way. Yeah. It's that same sort of process for me. And I think that's why I took to it so much.
There's something really satisfying about it also. Like at the end, when you heard it in your head and when you've done it really well, you go, that sounds even better than I hoped it would sound.
Exactly.
You know? And it's like, and when that happens, it doesn't happen every time, especially with me, but when it does happen, it's like, man, I'm so happy. You know what I mean?
Yep.
Like, and now it's much easier than it was back in the day. I mean, it's like now I could sit at finale and I hear it kind of back and I'm like, yeah, I don't like that. I'm like, you know, I mean, it's like super cheating, not cheating, but compared to the way people had to do it. But I mean, you know, but once again, I'll go back to Sam. Sam would tell me about arranging stuff with Empire Brass all the time. And they were sitting in a hotel room with manuscript paper and he couldn't hear anything. It was just like, you hear it in your head, you play it with a group, and it sounded good or it didn't, and then you redo it later on. It's like, here, at least I can have a finished kind of polished product before it goes out, and, you know, and it's legible, and it's, you know, all that stuff. Yeah, I was really curious about how it worked with you, because you do so much of it, and you're really prolific now, which I'm sure didn't hurt your audition with Oberlin and all that stuff. I mean, it's like, when they know that they've got not only a fantastic horn player, not only somebody who's been around the world countless times with a world famous chamber group, but somebody also who is a prolific arranger and composer and stuff. I mean, it's like, how can you not choose you? I mean, I don't even understand how you thought that you weren't going to get the gig.
I was thinking. God's honest truth, though, I left that day thinking, they don't want me, man. I bombed. They don't want me. Yeah, you can never be confident about something like that because so much of it is out of your control. Like the notes you actually play. Yeah. Okay, that part you can control. Little 20-minute recital, you know.
Sometimes you can't control that either. Hey, least...
Sorry, I take that back.
Like, what did I just play? What just came out of my home?
But I mean, man, I remember sitting in the hotel room after the day was over. And I go, I hope they do like the fact that I do other stuff. It's a real package. I'm like a whole package.
Package. You're like the girl. Yeah, you're like the on the movie where the girl goes on the date. How could he not like me? The full
package. Oh man, this life is so unpredictable. Anyways,
look at where we are now, man. And I got to tell you, man, it's just so nice to just talk to you. I don't get to talk to you that often anymore.
Likewise, man. I know. There was a time period where our paths crossed a lot more.
Right. Well, we were doing that really cool. I mean, the Porgy and Bess project was really cool.
Do you remember any of the actual places where we did that? It was a while ago.
what I do remember, though, man, and I'm going to be totally candid with you, it was so funny. So like when we used to do those shows, our personnel was different also. Boston Brass had some different personnel. You had different personnel. And some of the guys in our group were very time conscious. It was like, I mean, and you know me and Jose, we are just very, yeah. I mean, it's like, okay, you meet in the lobby at 8. That means like I'll probably show up like at 8:06 or you know, whatever. And it's like, so we get to the first rehearsal with Imani.
I know.
And it was like, you know, rehearsals at maybe like 11 or something like that. It's like 11:10. It's 11:20. It's 11:25. And here comes Imani Wins, and they roll in with their food. And you guys are like eating like takeout and shit. You guys... And these guys have been like, they're like huffing and puffing, like looking at their watches. And me and Jose look at each other and we're just laughing. We're just, yeah. Oh, we loved it. Did I ever tell you about what happened, like with my arrangements right before that, like right before we had to play the very first one that we did? I was flying home from a tour. And I had like a Marcus Bonnet case that had like a zipper pack on the back so I could put my laptop into it and stuff. I was at an airport and somebody stole my laptop out of it. Out of that thing. And I had just finished like my whole part of the show, like the whole Porgy and Bess thing. And I did not have it on a hard drive, like an external. So
it got...
The whole thing got stolen. I had to buy a new computer and rearrange the whole freaking thing.
Stop. Quit. No. Yeah. You can't be telling.
And this is 2 weeks before we were like gonna like perform the thing. I remember Boston Brass was in Japan on this awesome Japan tour, and I had just got the new computer and I didn't get to enjoy any of the tour because the whole time every bus ride we were on, every train ride, I was rearranging that entire show so that I could get it out on time to do this.
Oh my God, I'm so sorry.
Somebody stole my computer, man.
That hurts now, and I know it happened like, you know, almost 20 years ago.
Oh, it was brutal. It was brutal. And I just remember the guys, they're going out for drinks and they're going to have like this and that. And I had to like stay in their range. And it was shit that I had already done.
And then Imani Wynn shows up late for the rehearsal.
And then you guys stroll in with your Chinese food or whatever it was. You.
Dang, God, man. Sorry, we were the prototypical jazz quintet. Like, oh, I guess lobby call is now. Shoot, I'm gonna get one more coffee. Can we stop at Starbucks before we go?
Exactly. Yeah,
that was, man. Oh, we used to, and I'll tell you a quick insight. We had it so bad with timing, like being on time.
Mm-hmm.
That we decided to institute a dock and pay thing. Mm. So for every, I forget, for every minute or for every 5 minutes, you lose $10. I can't remember what it was.
Uh-huh.
It didn't matter. It didn't matter. Like, people would still be like a half hour late. They were like, oh man, you know, I had a blah, 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 but just take it off my pay.
That's amazing. That's awesome. When I'm on the road, man, I don't know what it is, but if I know I have to be downstairs at 8, that means I'm going to leave my hotel room at like 8:01 or 8:02. So by the time you hit like the elevator, and then of course you got the super slow people and the elevator takes a long time. And then it's like, I get down there and it's like 8:07 and everyone's like, where were you? And I'm like, oh, well, but I left my room on time. I don't know. Just road stuff, man. You know?
Man, I could go on, and I'm sure you have stories. I could go on and on about similar situations, man.
Well, I remember you telling us about the chocolates. We all got a crack out of that.
That is, and in all honesty, that was the way to keep the peace, man. We when we were on tour for like a long time, like almost 3 weeks, I'd have to like put chocolate under the door to keep the peace, man. I'd go to like CVS and get a big bag of chocolate kisses or something.
You know what everybody liked? You're like, okay, she likes the Nestle's chocolate. No. You like the Kit Kats? So I'm gonna put the Kit Kat under this door.
Because, man, it would get vicious sometimes.
Oh, I can only imagine, man. Vicious. Yeah, it's well, you know, when you're on the road and you see each other more than you see your family, yeah, people are going to get fed up with each other at times, or people are going to get like little things will start to bother you or whatever it is. And it's just like, that gets rough, you know. But I mean, I got to tell you, we're at a point with our group right now. Right. And I tell people this all the time. I've never been in a job situation where there wasn't like that one person who kind of ruined it. You know what I mean? It's like, you know how like you're in a like a perfect like a Goldilocks situation, except for that one person, and like it's, if you weren't here, this shit would be awesome. I'm not throwing out any names or anything. I'm just saying, it's like that was always like that, and for the past like couple years, this group has just been like, there isn't that person. So maybe it's me. I guess it's like, what?
No. Yeah. But I get it. I totally get it. It's a true thing. But I also think it's maturity. I think, you know, we were all in our 20s and 30s and, you know, we're out living the dream and wanting our own independence and to do things our way. And, yeah. And it took time for everybody to sort of just calm it down a little bit. You know?
Yeah.
Just calm it down, man. Oh, and it's funny because, you know, it was a group with me and four girls, and you would think we'd just be like, you know, just your docile wind quintet. These girls can party, man.
I remember. I remember after the concerts, man. They were the queens of the road, that's for sure.
Man, me, Miriam, and Monica, we were road dogs. We were just road dogs, boy. Yeah. Where we drinking? Where we going? Where we drinking?
Where's the party at? Especially when you're younger. I don't know if you're like I am, but it's like when I started touring when I was like in my early 20s, and I could go out, I could have a really good time, and then the next day, I'm like fine for a concert or a clinic or whatever it is. I feel clear-headed. I feel good. Dude, now I'm like in my early 40s, and I'm like foggy the next day. My chops don't work right. So it's like, if I have a concert the next day, I can't like hang like this. I have to be very careful now, because if I'm not... bad things happen to my face. But, you know, so you're just a little bit more conscious of it and everything. Well, but how old were you when you first started touring? I'm just curious.
22, 23, something like that.
Yeah. Oh, you were having a good time.
Yeah. I did this really hokey gig called the Mantovani Orchestra.
I never heard of that.
Uh-uh. Mantovani was this band leader, kind of like Sousa kind of band leader, but he was the band leader for this all strings orchestra, and they'd always have like one or two wind instruments and some singers. Uh-huh. And he would do arrangements of things like Tea for Two and
Okay.
You Want to Be Pictures, and everything would be three octaves too high. It's the music that you call elevator music, you know?
Yeah, I think, you know what? Now that I think about it, I think I have. It's pretty famous, right?
Very famous.
Yeah, so I do know. I have heard of it. Yes, for sure.
The Mantovani Orchestra back in the 30s and 40s was like it. It was it. Anyway, it still exists in whatever form. And I did that for a couple of years. That was my first touring job.
Huh. Interesting. Crazy.
Yeah.
Now, you toured with other people, though, also, right? I mean, who else did you tour with?
Man, some serious stuff. You said Luther Vandross.
Right.
That was a huge tour. That was like 7 weeks of Luther Vandross. Man, that was intense. Oh,
that is so cool.
Barbara Streisand, her first comeback tour. She's done like two since then. Her last tour, her last comeback tour.
Was that first comeback tour in the 90s?
Yeah, it was 90, I think it was 95.
Whoa, trippy. Okay. I'm sure you played in Vegas then.
Yes, yes. And we stayed at the MGM.
That's awesome. Okay, so my sister will enjoy this. My sister, she's was a really great percussionist, but she's an even better singer. And so she was like, she would sing in choirs and stuff like that. But she's a great blues singer and she's got real soul. But she got like a gig, like singing in a choir for Barbra Streisand. So she was on the gig with you.
No kidding.
Yeah, man.
Oh man. That's crazy, man.
And I remember my mom went to the concert because my mom's favorite singer of all time is Barbra Streisand. We used to listen to her all the time. But I mean, my mom was freaking out that my sister was going to sing in a choir. Yeah, but it's funny that you were on stage also. So it's like, you know, it's trippy because I'm not going to say it only happens to musicians, but quite frequently happens to musicians where it's like you were at the same place at the same time, but just didn't realize it and didn't know each other yet.
I was just going to say, it takes so many of us to make a big show like that happen that you could have 30 people on the other side of the hall that you don't even know exist, you know?
Never meet them.
Yeah.
So I went to school with a dude named Nathan Tanawe. He's a trombone player. And he played this show called Storm, like in the early 2000s, like maybe right around 2000. And the guitar player was the one who ended up hiring people for the show. And this guitar player used to work with Ricky Martin. And so he wanted to hire Jose, and he actually did hire Jose to come play that show Storm in Vegas. But then Jose decided he didn't want to like move to Vegas. Me and Jose joke about this all the time because it's like, I would have known Jose 5 years earlier, but he didn't take the job, so we didn't get to know each other. And then we end up playing in the same quintet.
And then you end up being like buddies, like, that's so freaky.
Yeah, it's just weird how stuff happens. Yeah, I mean, it's all the time. Just like me and you talking right now. You were doing that class at Chautauqua, and that was that was in 2002.
Jeepers, 2002, man.
Yeah.
Wow. That's a long time ago. Jeez.
What's sad is that we can say that 2002 is a long time ago. Now I'm at the point to where I'm like talkative because we've been.
That's good. That's the best part.
Yeah, I watch movies with my kids, and I'll be watching like Back to the Future or something like that. And it's like, he's in 1980, but he goes back to 1955. So he goes back 25 years. And I'm like thinking, that's like me now going back to 1995. It's like, that wasn't that long ago. But when you watch a movie and the difference between the 80s and the 50s is so radically different. And then now that I think about it, the difference between now and the mid 90s is pretty radically different. But when you're old, or middle-aged, I guess, it's like, it doesn't seem that way. It's like, what's going on, man?
You know, think of it this way. Nobody had a website in 1995.
That's true. Although I still have the same email address.
No kidding.
I do. I have an AOL. Everybody makes fun of me for it.
You still have an AOL account?
Stop
your lying, man.
I'm serious. Every time I have to give somebody my email address, I'm like embarrassed now because I'm like, and I named it when I was in high school. So it's like kind of lame. It's Sir Horn, SirHorn. Sir Horn at AOL.com. They're like, AOL, Sir Horn. What is going on with this? But now I can't change it. I'm too deep in. It's like that dude who's got like the crazy mullet and the mustache bar like this, and he can't. He's had it for so long that he can't. Persona. He can't change it anymore.
Changes. You won't know who he is, right?
Yeah, that's me with my email address.
Oh, wait a second, though. Now, I don't want to get too personal, but do you have to pay for AOL?
No. No. Okay. I think AOL gave up on that a long time ago.
Because here's the thing. I did a similar embarrassing thing. I held on to my Juno account for years. I had a... I know, see?
Juno is worse.
Dude, I had a Juno account until about... It could not have... I mean, I probably ended it about 6 or 7 years ago. But I had it concurrently with everything else. And I was afraid to get rid of it because I was like, man, people won't know how to reach me. And it was $17.99 a month.
You were paying for it?
Paying for it, dude. Because as they were closing it down, they were raising the price because they weren't making any money. So all of us people who were hanging on were just like supporting this poor company.
I got a Juno account that I pay $120 a month to.
Like Monica, she'd be like, dude, when are you gonna get rid of that doggone Juno account, man?
Yeah, you know, I probably should have a Gmail account or something like that. My wife has it. You know, everybody's cooler than me, but you know, I feel kind of about the AOL account. I feel like I'm like driving around one of those like cool old cars or something.
Well, yes,
it's a classic.
That's all right. Well, as long as you're not paying, it's all good. No, man.
I'm definitely not paying. That at least I don't weird. Think I am. You know, sometimes they're sneaky. Maybe I have been paying. I don't know.
Well, check your Apple account just to check, just to see if you're like paying it and you don't even know you're paying it. Because, dude, it was pretty sad. It was embarrassing. Paying almost $20 a month for email. And everybody was doing it for free. it was such a dumb, you know?
That's only $200 a year, man.
It's awesome.
$240 a year.
God, just a complete dumb.
So what have you been filling your time with lately?
Well, on the writing side of it, I got a bunch of arrangements done that I've been promising myself that I was going to do for probably 5 years. Mm. And they're not terribly like big projects. It's just that we've been so busy and I've been so busy with other life stuff. We just haven't had the time to like just do it. I've always had a commission or something else more important to do.
Right.
So I got those done. I'm actually writing, I don't even want to like, I shouldn't even say it, but I'm going to say it because if any horn players hear this, it'll tease the when it does come out. I'm actually writing a horn concerto.
Oh, dude.
And it's dedicated to somebody. I don't want that person to know just yet, but that person.
I thank you so much, man. Thank you.
Dog on it. It's out. But I've been wanting to write this horn concerto for this person for a couple of years now. And yeah, it's like one of those things where this was just like perfect timing to be able to just sit down and like really think out, like sketch out what I want to do so that when it does get busy again, I can do like portions of it and I'll know what I have to have a graph. That's the way I operate. So that I've been gardening like you, dude, I've got,
you have the pink gloves.
They're yellow. It's just as bad.
So you've been gardening.
You've been writing.
Been
a lot of writing. You know, I got to move. So you can't see it, but the house has got like tons of U-Haul boxes filled. The place is ready to pack up. So in about a little less than 3 weeks, we'll be moving to Ohio. So this has been, you know, a project of getting getting that all set up.
Are you excited about your new place?
We don't have one yet. We're homeless. Does anyone have a place, a couch we can stay on?
Oh. But have you been house hunting or anything like that? I mean.
Well, we tried. It's hard when you're in Connecticut and you're moving to Ohio. Yeah. We went out, we drove out about 2.5 weeks ago now.
Uh-huh.
We saw some houses, the houses that we ended up wanting, there were two, and they slipped right through our fingers, like other people put in bids, you know, that sort of thing. Yeah. And it's just, you know, when you're so far away, you just can't see the new stuff. So what we decided to do was move out of here early. And fortunately, the folks at Oberlin are really cool. They're going to let us stay in one of the faculty apartments.
Oh, nice.
Free of charge. And they're just going to let us stay there until we can find a house. And so, yeah, we're just going to put all of our stuff in storage, live off of what we need. And
smash cut to 10 years later, you're still on the So I haven't paid a mortgage or rent in 10 years, baby. 10
years, man. The doggone apartments that they have are literally like two blocks away from the campus, man. I can get spoiled, you know.
Get used to that. Yeah, you can get used to that.
Yes.
Oh, that's cool. But that's got to be part of the fun part. I mean, I'm sure your whole family is looking forward to like looking for a new place and checking it out. I mean, for you, it's a whole new adventure. I'm sure you guys had the talk like, well, I'm on the road for 100, 130 days a year.
Well, you know, one of the things that this will do, though, is it'll negate the necessity for me to have to take really all those other extraneous freelance gigs mm-hmm. that would also take me away from home. Because that's really, it wasn't even so much the 100 and so days on the road, which, you know, it's for some relationships like mine, it's nice to have some distance, you know. Everybody needs their space, man.
Just like Peter Cetera says, man, everybody needs a little time away.
I heard him say, yes.
Yep.
So, but it's that other stuff. It's like, okay, the other days when you should be home, dude, I just got called to play this gig for $350. I can't turn it down. I got to, you know.
Yeah.
It's that stuff. And I won't have to do that anymore. And that'll be kind of cool to, you know, just be home and do my thing, you know.
That's fantastic. And if another pandemic comes around, you'll be set.
Which they say is more likely than not, you know.
Yeah, I'm hoping not because I don't have a teaching job, man. I'm going to be working at Walmart, baby. I'll be like, the cereal is over there. And the pork rinds are over on aisle 18.
We will all be working at Walmart because I'll tell you, who's going to sit on a campus if there's no safety? I mean, right now – they're saying that there won't be any orchestras for the fall semester, mm-hmm. that even when you do your private teaching, it's going to have to be socially distanced. And these small ensembles, and you know this, it's fine to play your concert distance out on the stage because you really know the music and you've rehearsed. But when you're rehearsing, nobody wants to rehearse 6 feet apart.
No. Well, that's the worst thing. I mean, it's one thing that it's tough to teach when you're at home and it's, you don't get to hear the students the way you want to. And it's an inconvenience for you, but it's even more sad for the students because they're moving away from home. They're going to these campuses. They're like excited to be part of.
That was really weird. I'm on my computer and it just.
I actually thought it was mine because everybody has the same ring now. Remember, there was like a point like about 15 years ago when you had like all those customized rings on your, like that was the coolest thing you could do with your phone. Was to have a customized ring.
Yep.
It was like, And so everybody had different shit. You knew if it was your phone, but now everybody has the same exact. But anyway, what I was saying is I feel bad for the students.
I've had a few conversations with some of the incoming students at Oberlin. And, you know, you could just tell in their voice and in their eyes, they're just kind of like, you know, so what's, you know, what's going on? Like, you know, and I do my best, you know, it's hard because I, so much of what's going to happen depends on what the political mucky mucks say, you know, I mean, I have no control, you know.
Of course. Yep.
But yeah, you could tell that they have this vision and this dream of what going to college, your first time going to college should be. And this ain't it, you know. This ain't it.
I know, I would have been bummed. Yeah, I mean, so that's another good thing about that school having a teacher like you, because you're the creative type and you're the type of person who can like come up with projects for the students to do, come up with like just things that you're going to make it fun for them. You're going to make it educational for them. A lot of teachers can't do that. Yeah, I mean, it's just not in their DNA. You know, they've been doing it too long, or they've been, it's just not how they roll, and they're just going to try to buy the book it. And so I feel like your students are going to be very fortunate. Whatever comes along, you're going to find a way to make it worth their time, worth their while. And they're also going to be able to learn a lot and accomplish a lot.
I hope so. I hope so. You know, I'm scratching my head on things to do. I have some ideas. But it's funny you said that, because I just told a couple of the students that I was talking with this week that I'm going to do a town hall of just the Horn Studio. Uh-huh. And let them just throw out ideas. Like, this first semester is going to be a freaking drag.
Yeah.
But we're going to make the best of it. And let's talk about things, fun things we can do to like just keep it going. So I'm going to have a town hall with them in a couple of weeks and just let them, you know, on Zoom, of course, and just let them, like, you know,
yeah,
they think, you know.
That's great, man.
It's tough, man. That's, you know, when you're spending like $40,000, $50,000 to go to a school.
That's incredible.
Yeah. I mean, come on, man.
Yeah, man. So do you have grad students there too? You have grad students there too, right?
No, it's a strictly undergraduate. It's
strictly undergraduate. Okay, that's what I thought. I'm a little bit bummed, though, because I need to get a master's. So I was hoping I could go study with you.
First one, I'm like, dude, stand up. I'm sitting in the chair. You tell me.
No. No, man. I need to study some Jeff Scott, baby.
Man, these doggone challenges you're putting on Facebook, embarrassing everybody. Oh, God.
I gotta do something with my chat.
Dude, it is so freaking hot. That last one you did, that solo challenge, I don't know what, I forget what the tune is, but it's that that high thing.
That was actually something that, oh man, I can't remember his name. He challenged Bill Bernardis, my old horn teacher, to do, and then nobody was doing it. And so, yeah, and so he tagged my name to it, and I'm such a sucker for that stuff, man. I'm like, I'm all lame. I am a little bit lame when it comes, I'm kind of like my AOL, I can't help it. I can't. You know,
it was like, well, you were doing that stuff long before it became fad during the pandemic. You were doing those kinds of videos and recordings and stuff long before that.
I have been doing like the multitrack, like the arranging for, you know, 8 horns and then recording it all myself. And before acapella was a thing or anything like that. I have the equipment to do this stuff, though, because I've been buying the stuff. And so that's why I only have a PS3.
Your poor kid. Your poor son.
Instead of having the cool PS4, I've got like a nice microphone. You know what I'm saying?
It's terrible.
No, but it's funny because ever since this thing went down, I can't tell you how many messages, man. I've just, my inbox is like flooded with people who are like, what do you record with? What do you use? What do you this? What do you that? I'm like, all you have to do is like a little bit curious about shit, you know? So, but, you know, now everybody is though, because everybody's stuck at home. Yep. And for me, it wasn't that I had an abundance of free time. It was that in order to keep myself motivated and to keep myself off of the couch in front of Netflix with a bag of Doritos, I instead would just say, you know what? I like this song. I'm going to arrange it for horn. I'm going to multitrack it. And, you know, and there's nothing better for your ears. So if you want something that you need to be doing for your students, that's what they should be doing, man. Is like figuring out some multitrack stuff, make them arrange, make them record it. And they don't necessarily have to put it out there, but just make them do the process and learn the process. Dude, the first thing that you learn about yourself when you multitrack for the first time is, wow, my time really sucks. And wow, my pitch really sucks. It sucks. Yeah, you know? It's like you learn these things about yourself. You're like, wow, I can't even play with myself. How am I gonna play with other people? You know,
unless you're Chris Colmer doing Till.
I heard it.
It's sick.
Mind blown. I heard it. Chris Colmer. I mean, I don't know him personally, but I've met him like once. But that dude, there are these people that aren't everyday names to the community of horn or the community of whatever instrument it is. It's like, not every horn player is talking about Chris Colmer like they're talking about like a Phil Myers or something like that. But
right,
he's out there and he's doing all the work, and he's also like, he can play all different styles, and he's like, he's a monster, man. And it's just like one of those quiet, like it's like a sleeper, like one of those sleeper cars that's like sits at like the red light, and it like looks just like a normal car, and then this is Lamborghini, and the car just like smokes the shit out of the Lamborghini. It's like, yeah, man, that's those guys, you know. And they and those people are, they're everywhere on every instrument. So it's like, you can't think that just because somebody is not visible online all the time or whatever, that they don't exist.
They don't exist, right? Yep.
Yeah. I mean, well, I just interviewed Jerry Peel the other day.
Ooh.
And it's like, I mean, he's a good friend of mine, and he's like one of those guys that he recorded everything. He was like the king of New York for a while, and it's just like, and you heard him, you know him, but not that many, like, people don't know his name as much as they know like a Vince DeRosa or this person. Exactly. But I mean,
that's,
it's like
a good analogy.
Yeah, and it's like, you hear Jerry P. I saw a thing on YouTube the other day, and it was like, you know, the Chuck Mangione lullaby.
Yeah.
And it's like, and it ends, and Jerry Peel's playing it, and he ends on like a high F above C on this thing, on a mainstream record, and he plays this high F above C, and then he shakes it to like a, and it's like, so I go onto YouTube and I'm checking it out, and somebody goes, yeah, this is Vince DeRosa. It's like, no, it's not Vince DeRosa. Vince DeRosa is amazing, but there's other people, you know, and you just don't know. You're so much fun to talk to. I've missed you so much, man.
Likewise, man. Likewise. This has been a blast. I haven't laughed this much in a long time. Is there a way to subscribe to these?
There will be, yeah. This, as of now, I haven't released any episodes.
Right.
But only because I haven't like set everything up. I've actually interviewed quite a few people. So they're going to be coming out every week. Music on the Rocks is all about the after concert hang, you know, and that's the vibe I wanted. I want to like, I don't want it to be formal, like, so what did you, blah, 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 or anything like that. It's like, I just want to talk with friends, and that's my excuse to have a good time with people like you, man. So thank you.
Good stuff.
All right, man. Well, I'll catch you later. And thank you so much. And to everybody who's listening, you just heard Jeff Scott, and you know, now you know him a little bit better, and you know what a great dude he is. And if you're thinking about going to school somewhere, now you know where to go to school. So, all right, man. Okay.
All right, bro. You good.
All right, you too. Bye.